Every inch of that place, every grain of sand, wanted desperately to kill us. The author of that line is writing about Iraq, and he should know. He's a former Marine, Michael Petrie, who's written a compelling new novel about the Iraq War. The novel, titled Fives and 25s, is told in the voices of a Marine lieutenant, a medic, and their Iraqi interpreter. Michael Petrie joined the Marines after 9/11. He was a history and creative writing major at Louisiana State. He became an officer and served two tours in Iraq's Anbar province, not in combat. He was in logistics and communications. Pedestrian is how he describes his experiences there. But Petrie told me when he came back home, his wife pointed something out. She noticed he was telling decoy stories when friends asked about the war. Funny, innocuous stories to move the conversation along. And he was keeping the upsetting things secret.
And my wife telling me that made me feel bad. I felt like a coward. So my personal stories are actually pretty dull. I did not have an exciting, action-packed Iraq experience, but my close friends did, and I was there, and their stories weren't being told the way I thought they should.
Well, let's lay out the storyline of the unit that's at the heart of your novel. It's a road repair crew in Iraq and a bomb disposal team working with them. Talk a bit about their mission and how they do it.
Well, their mission is to fill potholes, to repair the roads and highways of western Iraq. The problem is the potholes are created by IEDs, roadside bombs, and the insurgent cells were planting IEDs in the same potholes over and over and over again. So when you would go out to repair the potholes, you had to first clear the bomb that was waiting for you. So it was just this endless grind of really brutal manual labor in a very dangerous environment. And if this was not my job, it was the job of a very close friend of mine named Ed Donahue. And I asked him the question, how many of those potholes had another bomb in them, Ed? And he said, oh, every single one.
One of the characters in your book, when he comes back from Iraq, is asked that question, you know, how many potholes did you fill? He says, 647. How many had a new bomb in them?
647.
Every single one, yeah.
Yeah. I wanted to tell a story that didn't fetishize combat. It was a war story with very little real combat as we know it. Because war is work, right? It's sweaty and it's exhausting, and sometimes it's carrying bags of concrete in the 130-degree sun and wondering if you're just going to get engaged by a sniper when your back is turned. And it was not glamorous, and it's not SEAL Team 6. It's just work. And I wanted to tell a story about that.
Is that something you found in other war writing, that it does fetishize combat in a way that makes you really uncomfortable?
No, not. I mean, as long as there's context. The combat in Iraq, the fighting done by the Marines there, was not an end unto itself. We didn't go there to fight just to fight. The fighting was part of a larger military mission, and that military mission was the safety and security of the Iraqi people. That was the reason why I included a narrator who was Iraqi. It was really their war much more than it was ever ours, and I wanted their story told as well.
The Iraqi character whom you mentioned is the interpreter who's working with this road repair crew. He's known as a Terp for interpreter,
yeah.
And he's given the name Dodge.
Yes.
He's a young guy. He likes Metallica. He likes rap music. He was working on a thesis on Huck Finn back in Baghdad, and a lot of the story is told through his eyes. How hard was it for you to try to understand the war from his perspective and his conflicted perspective in the middle of it?
It took some thought and it took some soul searching. And I knew a number of interpreters, none of whom are direct inspirations for Dodge. He's really an invention. And putting myself in his shoes, it wasn't that hard, honestly, because you saw it every day on those guys' faces that they had to go home to this at the end of the day when you got to go home to sunny California.
I'm talking with Michael Petrie about his novel, Fives and 25s. Michael, I should have you explain the title, Fives and 25s, which refers to something specific that this team has to do.
Yeah, well, it's not just this team. It's any convoy that was on the road in Iraq or Afghanistan, for that matter. Fives and 25s refers to a tactic to maintain safe distances from possible roadside bombs. So if you were on a convoy and someone in the lead vehicle saw something suspicious that they needed to stop and investigate, the first thing everyone would do scan 5 meters around the wheels of their Humvee to make sure that they weren't parked next to a bomb. So once everyone's clear in their fives, they dismount and do their 25-meter sweep, where they establish a larger zone of protection. But it also became a metaphor for protecting yourself. I heard it more than once in a Southern California bar. Two young Marines, one of them's too drunk, and his buddy says to him, "Hey, man, watch your fives and 25s," meaning, you know, stay safe.
You know, I wonder, as you were creating these characters, some of whom are deeply flawed, they're not necessarily what we might think of as heroes in the traditional sense, how tricky a balance that was for you to find, of wanting to portray the whole of the experience and not glamorize it, not sanitize it, but also you must have deep loyalty to the Marine Corps and how it's seen.
I do. And my loyalty to the Marine Corps and to those with whom I served, my loyalty to them led me to want to tell a true story. And as I was writing it, and this is, in all honesty, a manuscript I never thought would be read by anyone other than my wife, I sent it out to my old friends from my old battalion and said, "Hey, read this." And the subject line was always, "Read this and tell me if I've brought dishonor to our Corps." And no complaints from them, which is what matters to me most.
Mm. You do seem to reserve the bulk of the critical pen for the State Department and for contractors and for people who really put the Marines in harm's way in very tangible ways. But that seems to be where the true, not venom,
right,
but where the true exasperation comes out on the page.
There's no getting rid of that. That exasperation will last the rest of my life, I know. I mean, you were dealing with a whole Marine Corps that was marched into this area of desert without a plan at all. And then you see around you contractors and folks who are really profiteering, was what a lot of it was. And there's a line in the book in which Lieutenant Donovan says to Dodge, "Hey, I think we're going to remember this war as the last time we were disappointed by our parents." And I do hold to that. There was this sense in Iraq that, you know, your dad had taken you on a vacation and didn't bring gas money and you were stranded. So the Marines on the ground in Iraq did the best with what they had. But in the end, there was no real strategy. And that was... that was a shameful way to treat the U.S. military and to the volunteers.
I'm really curious to hear what you think as you read about and hear about what's going on in Iraq now and the spread of ISIS and extremism, the territory that's been taken back. From your experience, well, how do you see that?
It's absolutely gutting if you think about it too long. And I have stayed up late at night watching the news, unable to sleep, thinking about, God, I've been in that town. I saw those people. And now that they're under the thumb of such brutality, when we told them to trust us, is truly gutting.
And what do you do with that?
You try to go to sleep. In my case, anyway. I'm long separated from the service. You call up your friends. You have a heart-to-heart. And you try to move on with your life.
I've been talking with Michael Petrie. His novel is Fives and 25s. Michael, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
By the age of five, most of us may know the books of Richard Scarry. He wrote and illustrated hundreds, introducing children to numbers and letters. And, of course, what do people do all day? To commemorate the 50th anniversary of his most famous work, Richard Scarry's best word book ever, Scarry Classics are being re-released by Random House, along with something new, an unpublished manuscript and sketches that were discovered by Richard Scarry's son, in his father's studio. Richard Scarry Jr., who's known as Huck, completed the artwork himself for Richard Scarry's best lowly worm book ever. It's out next week. He joins us now from Vienna, Austria, to talk about the book. Mr. Scarry, thanks very much for being with us.
It's a great pleasure to be here.
You used to play in your father's studio?
Oh, yes. I used to spend a lot of time in my father's studio. It was a magical place. It was on the top floor of our house. And it was a great place to lie down on the floor with a big sheet of tracing paper, some pencils or magic markers, and draw away. And he would draw his books, and I would draw cars and airplanes and soldiers or whatever else a little boy likes to draw.
So how did you find this new book, new old book?
Ah, well, my father lived in a very funny little chalet in the mountains in Switzerland, and it is a clutter of a place. And I looked here and I looked there, and underneath my father's desk, I indeed found a rather dusty gray portfolio. And in there, there were a lot of sketches on tracing paper. So it was basically all sketched out, and the text had been written. It was done with my father's typewriter and taped down onto the pages. But he never got around to doing the final art, and so that's what I did.
The key to some of your father's stories, I think, sometimes is the extraordinary detail. And I think that's what youngsters love about the books in many ways. You just don't read them, you explore them.
Absolutely. He loved to put a lot of things on the pages so that the children would have a lot to look at. And he also wanted the parents to have a good time. And there are little asides here and there, little wacky things that you just pick up on and find amusing somehow.
Well, even a phrase just like "my trouser," which illustrates the sleeve that that Lowly Worm inhabits.
That's right. Lowly, of course, just has his trunk and one little foot, and so he wears an underpant. He doesn't have underpants. So a child isn't going to get the joke, but an adult will find that amusing.
Yeah. Do you happen to know how was it that that your father wound up creating a worm to be a signature character?
Well, as you said, he loved to put in lots of details into his spreads. And so then he came upon the idea of adding a little character that you'd have to find. And this worm didn't have any name at the time. But then he started getting fan letters from readers who were always looking for this worm and making drawings of the worm because he's rather easy to draw. And so then my father had to give him a name. And what is a worm? He's Lowly. And he is so optimistic, and he can do everything with his, just because he has this one foot, he can stretch and he can tie himself into knots, and he's very bright and funny, and he's just a wonderful character. I love working with him.
Huck, I hope you don't mind me asking. Millions of people are in a position to see what kind of artist your father was. May I ask what kind of father he was?
Oh, he was a fabulous father. I miss him. He died in 1994, and he spent a lot of time with me. And we went sailing or skiing, or we had a coin collection also. And for $1, you could get a whole roll of 100 pennies, and we would crack the roll open and spread it out on the table, and we would constantly look to fill in the missing spaces in our collector's book. We had a great time.
I have to ask you something as the artist who carries Lowly Worm forward. It has been hard for me to watch World Cup games without thinking of the picture of Lowly Worm kicking a ball.
Uh-huh.
And I cannot imagine how a worm kicks a ball. He's got one foot, but he would have to leave that foot to kick the ball. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's because you're an adult and you think too much. It's true. It's true. I have a lot of editors who are also adults, and they put too much thought into things. And you have to allow room for imagination and just let things be as they are. And kids understand that Lowly can kick a ball. They don't care that he can't back up and then run forward and kick it, but he kicks it.
Richard Scarry Jr., also known as Huck, speaking with us from Vienna. His father's Richard Scarry's Best Lowly Worm Book Ever is just appearing in the U.S. to help commemorate the 50th anniversary of Richard Scarry's Best Word Book Ever. Thanks so much for being with us.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be here.
One of the summer's biggest blockbuster movies, Guardians of the Galaxy, features a monosyllabic intergalactic crime-fighting tree named Groot. That's one of my favorite sentences I've ever said. He's the creation of Jack Kirby, who is something of a legend in the comic industry. Kirby also brought us Captain America and some X-Men characters. He died in 1994, but his birthday on August 28th has become something of a national celebration for comic fans. Jessica Blaustein, Marshall of member station WAMC, checked in on preparations for a Kirby Day celebration in upstate New York.
In the back room of a brewery just outside of Albany, a small group of comic shop owners and comics creators gather around a sketch of Jack Kirby. The likeness peers intensely out from the page, inking pen in one hand, pencil clenched in his lips. But it's not in a comic book. It's the label on a bottle of beer.
So I just wanted to capture his sort of artistic power, sort of an extreme view looking up from his drawing surface.
Artist Paul Harding is the sculptor behind a lot of the action figures you see in stores. He drew the image of Kirby. The group is slapping it on limited edition beer bottles in preparation for Kirby Day. As they work, they trade tales of the legendary Jack the King Kirby.
You know, when I was a kid, Jack's artwork frightened the hell out of me. I was really kind of weirded out by the square fingers and the tortured poses on all the characters, but I couldn't look away from it either.
Fellow party organizer Ron Mars has written for Silver Surfer, Green Lantern, and Witchblade comics, as well as the famous DC versus Marvel comics crossover series of the mid-1990s.
Anybody working in the industry now, whether you're a writer or an artist, stands on Jack Kirby's shoulders.
If you don't know comics, you may not know Kirby. You probably know his more media-friendly partner, Stan Lee, who tends to get more credit from both fans and publishers for creating the Marvel Universe. Kirby preferred the introspective quiet of his drawing board. Comic shop owner John Belskis was lucky enough to meet Kirby once at a convention. The King was sitting in the artist's alley by himself, completely overlooked, while convention goers flocked to celebs like Rob Liefeld and Stan Lee.
And I thought to myself, this is ridiculous. This is like a comic legend, and there's nobody here.
It was toward the end of Kirby's life when he suffered from arthritis and would not sign his work for fans. But Kirby and his wife Roz made an exception.
Roz kind of told me, give me the pages. And they went behind a curtain, and when they came back out, the pages were signed. Did she sign them? Did he? I don't know. It didn't matter at that point.
Belskis and company wanted to make sure Kirby and his contribution to pop culture were remembered. Their celebration springboards off a small national movement to celebrate his birthday, started by Kirby's granddaughter in 2012.
The comic community at large understands and cares. Fandom, guys with shops, guys that are creators, everybody.
Once all the labeling is done, the crew packs the bottles into cases ready for the birthday bash. Notable comics creators will be there, and they plan to auction off one-of-a-kind items like a statue of Groot. All proceeds will go to the Hero Initiative, a fund that helps provide a financial safety net for struggling comic book creators. For NPR News, I'm Jessica Blaustein Marshall in Albany, New York.
Before Co Booth became a writer, she was a caseworker with Child Protective Services in New York City, working with teenagers and families in crisis.
So I was the one who would remove children, unfortunately, and take them to foster homes. Mm. And a lot of times the foster parents would have children of their own. So I was always wondering, what would it be like for those kids to have these new kids come and leave and come and leave and not want to attach to them?
Co Booth's new book, Kinda Like Brothers, explores that question. It's a novel written for middle grade readers. It starts with the arrival of a new set of foster children in the home of 11-year-old Jarrett. He's been through this before many times, but always with babies. This time is a little different. A young girl named Treasure is brought to the house late one night, along with her 12-year-old brother, Kevon.
It's really hard for Jarrett to share his room with this kid who he, you know, views as a stranger. And all of a sudden, he's supposed to be like a brother to this guy. And it's really hard for him, especially Kevon, who is so much better at everything than Jarrett is. He's so much cooler, and it just drives my character crazy.
It certainly does. The parents in this story, the foster parent here, the mother, is in a strained relationship involving a lot of yelling, frustration. And, of course, Jarrett, you know, feels like she loves all these foster babies more than she loves him. Mm-hmm. I'd like you to read from chapter 37 near the end of the book where he expresses this to her in no uncertain terms.
Sometimes I feel like you care more about the babies than me. I mean, maybe when I was little, you loved me more, but now you don't even have time for me. They come first all the time. Mom gasped. Is that the way you really feel? She was looking at me like it was the first time she ever saw me. I'm sorry, I mumbled real fast. I didn't mean to. I shouldn't have said anything. No, no. Mom wiped the tears from her cheek. I'm the one who should be sorry. I know it's hard for you, all these babies around all the time, but they need me, and I don't know, maybe I need them too.
Co Booth reading from her new novel, Kind of Like Brothers. I wonder, how did you get inside the head of young boys? And I know you've done it in previous books, but I imagine that would be a challenge for anyone of the fairer sex.
Right?
You know, what did you do to make sure this rang true?
I think in every grown woman, there is an 11-year-old boy. No, I'm just joking. No, I don't know. I have nephews that they don't know it, but I've been spying on them while I was writing this book. And a lot of my book is set in a community center,
right,
much like the community center my nieces and nephews go to. I would just hang out there for a little while. I was the creepy lady, like, writing notes as the kids were running around.
You have some advice that is weaved throughout this book from, you know, men at the center to some of the younger boys, even about how to deal with police,
right,
that they have interactions with. Can you just review for us a little bit about that scene in the book?
Well, the scene in the book begins with Jared kind of walking up and seeing a counselor at the center getting stopped and frisked for no reason.
Mm-hmm.
And it really disturbs him. He's just really angry. That afternoon, a guy comes over to the center and he conducts man group where the boys get to ask questions. And of course, the stop and frisk comes up. And he just tells them, he's like, I'm going to keep it real with you guys. You know, you black and Latino boys are going to get stopped a lot. And it doesn't matter what you do or what you didn't do. It's just because of who you are. And in the meantime, I need to teach you what to do when the cops stop you, not if, when they stop you. And so they kind of run through drills. He's telling them what to say and what not to do, and so that they don't get hurt or get shot. Even Jared, at the end of that scene, realizes that what the guy is teaching them is really important and that this is not a joke.
You know, I have to tell you, in the environment we're in right at this moment, that rang very true to me.
When I see the situation that's going on in Ferguson, it does remind me of the scene in the book, because I think any parent or anybody who is dealing with young black boys, as is what's happening in the community center in this book,
mm-hmm,
I think every single community center has had this conversation with their boys. And it's just so sad that we have to do this, but we do. And I hope that changes. I don't know if what's going on in Ferguson will change that, but I do hope it's at least continues the conversation, because it's just, it's exhausting, you know, that this is still going on in 2014.
What are you hoping this novel brings to your readers' lives? You know, this is a book about a very particular population. Who are you trying to reach?
Everybody. But particularly, I want kids who see themselves in this book, because it's so hard to find books that are for them and about them. It's not a fairy tale. It's reality.
Right.
And it's, you know, it's complicated. But I hope it's true.
Co Booth is the author of Kinda Like Brothers, which will appear on bookshelves this coming Tuesday. Co, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
School is starting. That means lots of time in the classroom or library, sitting quietly, no distractions. But more and more brain science is saying that may not be the best way to learn. Benedict Carey covers medicine and science for the New York Times, and he's written a new book called How We Learn. Ben, welcome.
Thanks very much. Nice to be here.
And I'm going to play a game on my phone and look up tips on how to juggle and maybe take a nap while I'm talking to you. How does that sound?
That sounds good. Absolutely.
Because then I'm going to remember and absorb more of this conversation, right?
Yes, you are. Well, look, I mean, a lot of people think learning is all discipline. I know I believed it. And it turns out that scientists have discovered through a whole lot of different ways that it doesn't work that way. The brain is a foraging instrument. You know, it's a scavenger, just like humans were for so much of their existence. And once you appreciate that, be able to take some pressure off yourself to not worry that you're doing things right all the time, and to have a tactical plan when you study for something.
Right. Well, you talked about how, I mean, I think most of us grew up with this notion that self-discipline and focus are what we really need to learn something. And apparently that needs to be replaced by distractions and maybe even, as I noted, napping. So what is it about our brains that we know now that basically turns the whole concept of learning, shall we say, on its head?
Well, we know that quiet study, ritual, all those things we assume to be true, that assume to be self-evident, Those are only one way to study. A lot of the things we've learned, whether it's to cook or ride a bicycle or socialize, we've done those piecemeal. The brain is very good at learning on the fly during daily life. And to take topics and isolate them, you know, to sit there like a monk with the textbook, with the chemistry textbook. I mean, who wants to do that, right? It's difficult. I'm not saying it's that you throw it away. I'm saying that's only one environment where learning occurs. It also occurs throughout your daily life.
So a lot of this deals with memorization, but of course memorization doesn't necessarily translate into comprehension. So like you can know all the U.S. presidents' names and when they were in office, but that doesn't mean you understand history, right?
So that's right, yeah.
Does this new way of learning address that as well?
It does. There are a bunch of things that scientists now know improve retention, which is talking about, you know, foreign language, names, places, facts, and figures, yeah, and so on. And there are a handful of things also that seem to aid comprehension. For example, distraction. Distraction is one of those things everybody's worried about, certainly every parent, you know, with the iPhones and people jumping on Facebook and so on.
Right.
And, you know, of course, if you're spending your entire time tooling around on Facebook, you're not studying. So that's a problem. However, there's a whole bunch of science looking at problem solving. In problem solving, when you get stuck, you've run out of ideas. Distraction is really your best friend. You need to stand up, let it go, walk around the block, go to the cafe, drink a beer, whatever it is. And that is really your best shot at loosening the gears a little bit and allowing yourself to take a different and more creative approach to the problem.
You know, I wonder what some of these new findings mean to the current debate in education over things like Common Core and, you know, the idea of teaching to the test. Do you think these findings about how we learn could or should change how we evaluate what we learn?
The science addresses how you learn, how I learn, how an individual learns, and they are independent of any policy changes. Now, when it comes to standardized testing, there is a story to tell. There's a lot of interesting research now looking at using testing as a study tool in that self-examination or even doing tests before a course starts are both very intriguing, interesting, and possibly sort of revolutionary approaches to learning.
What are some practical ways then that we can take some of this new data and apply it to our own learning methods? Like, say, so I want to learn Spanish, which I actually do, or I want to get better at photography, which I do. What's your advice for me?
Well, one of the easiest things you can do, we'll take Spanish first, is simply move around. You don't need to stay in the same place. You don't have to have the same chair, the same cubicle, the same room to do your memorization. Changing context, changing environment aids in retention, in this case particularly in learning Spanish words. Now, photography, that's a different thing altogether. It's very creative. There, I tend to think of that more in the sense of what I call in the book percolation, which is an interesting thing that I think all adults who have learned something know happens. You know, you're starting a very big project. You don't even really know where to start. And the science on this says, just start the thing. You can quit 5 minutes later or 10 minutes later. Because what happens when you do that is that it activates your mind to begin sort of scavenging the environment and your own thoughts for what the relevant information is in your life.
All right. Well, I'm going to go back to the cake that I'm baking and the math problem in my checking account and see if I remember any of this conversation. How's that?
That sounds good. You've learned.
All right. Benedict Carey is the author of the new book, How We Learn. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Tess.